Welcome to Worker Movement, a podcast dedicated to the working class, a podcast dedicated to raising class consciousness. This podcast is for you, for us, for the worker.
In the second part of our discussion on Martin Luther King Jr., we start by analyzing his views on American imperialism. He remained publicly agnostic to the Vietnam War until he announced his opposition in a speech entitled Beyond Vietnam on April 4, 1967, exactly 1 year before his assassination.
Perhaps a more tragic recognition of reality took place, and it became clear to me that the war was doing far more than devastating the hopes of the poor at home. It was sending their sons and their brothers and their husbands to fight and to die in extraordinarily high proportions relative to the rest of the population. We were taking the black young men who had been crippled by our society and sending them 8,000 miles away to guarantee liberties in Southeast Asia, which they had not found in Southwest Georgia and East Holland. So we have been repeatedly faced with the cruel irony, watching Negro and white boys on TV screens, and they kill and die together for a nation that has been unable to seat them together in the same school. So we watch them in brutal solidarity, burning the huts of a poor village, but we realized that they would hardly live on the same block in Chicago. I could not be silent in the face of such cruel manipulation of the poor.
The key takeaway is, I could not be silent in the face of such cruel manipulation of the poor. Again, he references the class struggle of the poor working class against the imperialist machine, which was America.
This whole speech is designed to frame the imperialist war in Vietnam as a fight not only against the Vietnamese afar, but also a fight against the poor and the class struggle in the United States. It's a diversion tactic that it was primarily designed to divert resources to not to save the Vietnamese, but to not end capitalism and not fight poverty here in the United States. And that in its face alone means it's damaging, knowing the fact that we lost lives over in Vietnam, but also we lost any progress that could have been made in helping those, you know, within the United States.
And the context of the speech has two purposes. One is that he outlines that the poor working class is being exploited in Vietnam. They're being drafted. They're going to die effectively for the interest of American capital. And that's objectively true. And the other statement that he's signaling is that he is sending effectively a warning shot against the Democratic establishment, who was LBJ at the time, that this war is fucked up and you can't have racial equity and diversity and all of the civil rights concepts that the Democratic Party was advocating for on paper without having justice in the context of imperialism.
Yeah, absolutely. And it comes back to the justice part of it, right? Versus the law and order. And it comes back to capital's afraid of losing its grip on society and what it is. And you have Red Scare sweeping the nation, and you have the imperialists' only tool is warfare, is occupation and warfare. So how do you prevent, you know, the uprising of communism, you know, coming over and fighting Ho Chi Minh and his ability to better his people? Well, you call them terrorists and start a war with them, right? How do you stop the Black Panthers from getting anywhere? You say it's illegal to own guns in the street. How do you stop Black Lives Matter from being able to protest? You make it illegal and say that they're terrorists, domestic terrorists. It's the same tools over and over again. It just comes in different forms. And in this case, with this Beyond Vietnam, the entire premise is that you're taking the poor away. You're promising them a bright future, but only if they go and do the tasks that you need to murder, to kill, to stop, you know, communism from spreading.
And it's not even a transaction that's worth doing. If I'm a poor Black person in America and I go over and endure hell and then I come back and people spit on me and I can't use bathrooms and water fountains, at a very basic transactional level, that is not a viable like agreement that any person would make of their own volition.
So then it's forced upon you. You're drafted. You have no choice. You have to go. And that's the only way Vietnam worked, because nobody was signing up. Unless you're, of course, you were a senator's son, as that one song goes. And you just become a, you know, captain somewhere that directs the poor people to go die. But by and large, if the working class and the poor are the largest population segment, then you would expect that the population that gets drafted the most is the working class and poor. It's statistics, basic probability. One of the major things that Vietnam did was it desegregated the military, because it was forcing individuals to fight next to each other. But as you pointed out earlier, when they came back, there was no desegregation. They came back to a hostile 70s that just got done with the, you know, fight for civil rights. So at the same time civil rights are being fought, or at least the end of it, you have Vietnam in full swing. So we divert resources the entire time to fighting the Vietnamese, who were just attempting to create a different structure of government that would provide betterment to the entire country under the guise of imperialism and warfare, that we had to stop the communist Red Scare. It's a really fucked up premise when you take a step back. MLK's goal was not necessarily to just oppose the war and just get civil rights, but his goal was to increase the class awareness and raise the poor to standards of living that they had never seen before, basically through action. And Vietnam took that ability away from him. The bullet that entered his body took that away from him too, but it's more about the fight. You know, how do you fight multiple fronts? And you can't. And how do you fight patriotism? You can't fight patriotism. How do you fight the white moderate who just wants to protect his son or daughter from the Vietnamese who are thousands of miles away? You can't fight that. And we don't see any great movement on the needle of civil rights ever again. I don't actually see anything since then that actually shows me that civil rights was ever on anybody's plate.
I think the major lesson of Vietnam was that the industrial might of the United States could go over and fuck around with another country's sovereignty for effectively 10 years, commit large-scale genocide, and perpetually maintain their presence over there if they wanted to. The Vietnam War continued for 5 years after Nixon, way longer than 5 years after Nixon. 1968 was when he was reelected.
Yeah, he committed treason and another like hundreds of thousands of people died, dude.
The Vietnam War continued for roughly 6 or 7 years after Nixon became president on the premise of we're going to end the war because LBJ is just over there wasting American lives or something. Nixon committed treason by negotiating that the war would continue while the election was ongoing. LBJ knew about this, but chose to do nothing for various political reasons. And you had American industrial might basically suffer because the war became so unpopular for all the reasons that Martin Luther King outlined in 1967, some 8 years before the war actually ended. Martin Luther King was fundamentally right about why the Vietnam War was bullshit. And it took 8 years for anybody to realize it at a collective mass consciousness such that politicians had to act. And I think the takeaway long term is that it's easier to give breadcrumbs to the poor than it is to engage in this very direct, we're going to ship you off overseas to go fight in a war.
I mean, it has, you know, long-term damages, right? Diverted resources from the poor. It diverted large swaths of American industry over to fighting a war. It damaged the ability for the U.S. to actually, you know, do research and development and grow as a country and make any steps forward. And it created a whole generation of fuckheads that believe in patriotism to a level that that you can't even fathom. I mean, the insanity. That these colors don't run, fucking Kid Rock listening to assholes.
So this was effectively the birth of nationalism, where the ruling class figured out that if you just pounded your chest and said America, people would jump, and it wasn't necessary to wage an international military conflict with a foreign country in order to exploit people. People would willingly engage in the exploitation if they could be convinced that it was in the best interest of their country. I think America has changed from Vietnam era, and nationalism is effectively the driving force of the ruling class to get what they want. They propagandize, this is what you should do to be patriotic. And we saw this with the storming of the Capitol, is that if you convince enough people that doing the patriotic nationalistic thing is the right thing to do, people will do whatever you want. Propaganda still works, and it's not necessary to ship, you know, a million people overseas to fight communism. You can accomplish everything you want to accomplish locally by just getting people to believe in America.
Yeah, one of the prime examples of this is that we all know that the capitalists own sports teams. It's kind of like a little hobby. You don't watch sports, by the way. We know it's one of their hobbies. So what happens when you want to kneel for the flag as a way to say that you're not happy with police brutality? Well, the capital turns on you. They effectively bar you from being able to make money under capitalism, and they use every tool they have at their disposal to fight you. They run ads against you. They play fucking shitty country music for you. They try to sell you t-shirts that say things like, I stand for the flag and kneel for the cross and I blow Jesus because I love him so much. They say all that shit in order to keep you convinced and keep you pissed off at the other. So you don't actually critically think about why you're mad. You just are. You're just mad because somebody disrespected some fucked up belief that you think that you had about some dumbass thing some point in time in your life.
And you're talking about Colin Kaepernick.
I'm talking about Colin. Yeah, he's still not playing football. He's better than most of the quarterbacks out there. And I hate football, but at least I know that he's still not a, he's still there, right? He's still trying. They really screwed him over, and it was basically a shot in the, over the bow. If you fuck with us, you mess with capital, you mess with patriotism, you're done. Right? There's nothing else you can do about it.
And it's another example of the union not having any ability to do anything about it. So an action that could have occurred with the NFL Players Association is to say, you ban Colin Kaepernick, we're going to walk.
Yeah, absolutely. We're not playing another game. We'll all kneel on the 50-yard line together. But that's what we're going to do.
And you can throw away your billions of dollars in revenue that we don't see because we don't give a fuck.
We can argue that we can't play because of safety. We can say concussions are so bad right now we can't play until you fix this. Why? Well, because we have our boys back. You're not going to shit on us because you can't. But what happened?
Tom Brady is a white moderate.
Tom Brady is the MAGA-wearing white moderate who took out a PPP loan because his shitty company couldn't manage itself during the COVID downturn.
And Bob Kraft is spending all of his time getting out of his prostitution charges in Florida.
So the first podcast talked about how King was right about white moderates that is true to this day. We find out now that King is right about imperialism, how terrible it is, and why it didn't have the impact that it was needed or what was designed for at the time. And, you know, now we move on to the next quote, in which we talk about King as basically a radical that wants to essentially just end capital.
This excerpt comes from a speech entitled The Three Evils of Society, which he delivered to the National Conference on New Politics on August 31st, 1967.
Again, we have deluded ourselves into believing the myth that capitalism grew and prospered out of the Protestant ethic of hard work and sacrifice. The fact is that capitalism was built on the exploitation and suffering of black slaves. And continues to thrive on the exploitation of the poor, both black and white, both here and abroad. If Negroes and poor whites do not participate in the free flow of wealth within our economy, they will forever be poor, giving their energy, their talents, and their limited funds to the consumer market, but reaping few benefits and services in return. The way to end poverty is to end the exploitation of the poor, ensure them a fair share of the government services and the nation's resources. I proposed recently that a national agency be established to provide employment for everyone needing it. Nothing is more socially inexcusable than unemployment in this age. In the 30s, when the nation was bankrupt, it instituted such an agency, the WPA. In the present conditions of a nation glutted with resources, it is barbarous to condemn people desiring work to soul-sapping inactivity and poverty. And I am convinced that even this one massive act of concern would do more than all the state police and armies of the nation to quell riots and instill hatreds. And the tragedy is that our materialistic culture does not possess the statesmanship necessary to do it. Victor Hugo could have been thinking of 20th century America when he wrote, "There's always more misery among the lower classes than there is humanity in the higher classes." The time has come for America to face the inevitable choice between materialism and humanism. We must devote at least as much to our children's education and the health of the poor as we do to the care of our automobiles and the building of beautiful, impressive hotels. And we must also realize that the problems of racial injustice and economic injustice cannot be solved without a radical redistribution of political and economic power.
It's so obvious he doesn't even pretend to be subtle. He hits you over the head with it. But he can put it in the terms in which individuals understand what redistribution is. He doesn't have to say things like, "I'm going to take all the private property." He can just say things like, in the same context we hear today, "Let's raise minimum wage. Let's get everybody M4A. He can basically be, you know, a moderate Democrat or a little bit left just to start getting in the way, because any step forward is a better step forward. And that's what he's advocating here.
He takes the mask off a little bit and says, "Look, if I were king, this is what I would do." And then he dials it back a little bit and makes it accessible to everybody. He says the big, bad, evil word of redistribution. But that's literally what he means. That's what he wants to do. He doesn't say this is how we should do it. We should do this by taxing the rich. He says it's a fairness issue. He speaks in an everyman language to make it accessible to everybody so that the horrors of capitalism are clearly understood by the people listening.
And that's why he preferences it with these words like social equality, so that you understand that it's not just about money, that you understand that it's not fair to be treated like shit and beaten by cops. So he really understood what the problem was. The problem is the white moderate. The problem is this imperialism, right? This ability to try to control other people and support capital. But also that there's a group of people who do believe in fairness, who know deep down that there is a moral and ethical issue when it comes to racism or it comes to inequality. Now, they may not be willing to give up their life and give up who they are and fight on the streets and take a baton to the head. But they may actually sit there and fight for you for legislation. They may donate to the cause. They may provide legal services. They may do all the things that are needed, but not necessarily going to be the one on the front lines really advocating for it. And this is why it was so important for him to start to frame these messages in a way that were digestible. Because there's no way for us to talk to individuals who have no understanding of the material conditions of the poor unless you talk to them in the language they can understand.
And it's a messaging concept. He understood that this was a message that needed to be delivered. And during his era, the most obvious means by which his message could be conveyed is black people are treated like shit, white people are not. It's literally a black and white issue. It's visually observable. It's something that people can relate to. And he was able to get people not necessarily to buy in and take action and take a baton to the head, but he was able to convince people not to stand in the way of progress. People no longer needed to overtly do something to prevent progress. And that, I think, is why it was successful.
One thing that's always missing, you know, from the argument about redistribution of wealth, and King captures again and again and again, is that you don't have to necessarily lose your lifestyle to make someone's life better. That part about not standing away is hitting the nail right on the head about what people can do to be helpful. You don't have to be out there doing everything every day and being the only superhero on the streets. You just have to be a voice of reason when people are starting to act like assholes. Just not standing in the way. When someone says, I don't understand why these thugs are out burning down targets, you have to say something like, I don't understand why people are being shot by police without a trial. How can you have extrajudicial executions going on in the streets and not question it? The same thing happened with the material conditions in the 60s. How can you say that we are a peaceful society? How can you say that we have a great America? How can you say that America is for the free and the brave and all the bullshit you're saying when we have cops beating and hanging and hitting people with the fire hoses and not serving me at the diner? All you have to do is not stand in the way or say something like, it's okay if they eat here, or I don't support you hitting black people in the head with batons. You're not doing anything besides just being a voice of reason. And that is one of the most important things that King was able to do during the civil rights movement.
And to go to your example about, Black Lives Matter is bad because they're ruining private property. They're causing damage. They're inconveniencing people. It's frame it as, no, the people getting extrajudicially murdered are being inconvenienced. Who gives a shit about Target? But don't make it about Target and make it about their private property that was ruined. And that's a framing issue, and that's what he attempts to do here. He doesn't talk about how we need to tax the rich. He's expressing an idea about what should happen. He's not necessarily expressing how it should happen. And that's an important way to message concepts that doesn't happen today and people aren't good at. And that's a way by which you can contribute, by just not standing in the way of these ideas being presented.
Yeah, absolutely. There's another important part here that Chewy brought up, which is King's nonviolent approach. We won't sit and argue whether or not it was good or bad, or argue whether or not Malcolm X had it right or the Black Panthers had it right with the violence portion of nonviolence. But at the time, capital through the state had more force and the ability to use the force. And the individuals fighting for civil rights didn't have the guns, the tools, whatever necessary to fight back. So King knew the media would be there to shine the light on there. And the only way to win over the white moderate was to have them sympathize or empathize with the violence against them. To say, you know, look, they're hitting us. We're unarmed. Why would they do that to us? And so he basically weaponized peace. And it's not to confuse it with that King was a peaceful person. He just happened to find the form that was the right weapon to tear the hearts out of those that didn't want, you know, him to succeed. He fought them by basically making them look like pieces of shit and play at the heartstrings of the white moderate. And that tool worked. And it was weaponized time and time again. He found the right weaponization for the fight. The Montgomery boycott, they weaponized the amount of workers who would use the buses. The buses were used by a large population of the African-American community and the white. You take away half the income, the white cannot sustain themselves without increasing taxes, right? So now the burden is on the part of the society that wants to use the buses, who get to sit in the front, to now fund and subsidize it all. And they hit them exactly where they needed to. It's the same idea of a union where to say, you know, work to contract. You only do the work that the contract says. No more, no less. You file the grievances every single time the contract isn't being met. That's what the union should be doing, and that's how you'd weaponize it in the modern day society.
So King's entire pattern of presentation was to message an idea to a group of people, and we see this in the various quotes we've just discussed. It talks about ideas and abstract concepts that generally everybody should believe in. They're framed as inclusive. They're not singling people out. And he would increase a popular movement that would believe in his ideas. And then here's why he was effective, and it's for the reasons you just outlined with the Montgomery bus boycott, is he understood the resource allocation move that was going to be most beneficial based on the resources he was able to control. The Montgomery bus boycott was a fairly nominal and inexpensive action that would directly attack a demographic of people that he wanted to target, and it was successful. And this is the pattern that everybody should use for doing anything locally. Express the idea, figure out the group of people that are impeding progress. And in Martin Luther King's case, he identified this as a white moderate, and so he went out of his way to intentionally target the white moderate on various acts of civil disobedience that would, one, raise this idea of abstraction that he wanted to convey, so the idea of redistribution of wealth, the idea that anybody should be able to sit down at a diner and eat food regardless of your skin color, the idea that anybody should be able to drink from a drinking fountain, the idea that anybody should be able to sit anywhere on a bus, anybody should be able to go to any school. All those ideas were impeded by a group of people, and that was the white moderate, and he figured out how to make the absence of that idea being upheld inconvenient to the white moderates, and that's really where his genius was.
Yeah, this is not a reactionary movement. This is designed from the get-go to move the needle. This is an absolute war that was waged. I mean, it taxed him. It cost him his life, but he found the way to break it time and time again. And we are presently missing somebody of that stature right now. We are presently lost on the left as to what's next and where to go and how to frame any issue. I mean, we have the shittiest things right now, like the Green New Deal. It's like the New Deal, only green. Oh, okay. Well, thank you. Right? We have minimum wage increase. Right, I see. Not UBI, not taxing, not anything that actually makes substantial movements. Not redistribution of wealth, not fairness in taxation, none of that stuff. There's no arguments for it. There's no equity in the environmental movements. And it's really, we're left with things like it's calling them names or picking on them, but there's no actual movement in the needle that means anything on the left.
One of Martin Luther King Jr.'s last speeches occurred on March 18, 1968, 2 weeks before he was murdered, before a crowd at the Mason Temple, a Pentecostal church in Memphis. And it pretty much wraps up his entire worldview of America.
And I come by here to say that America, too, is going to hell if she doesn't use her wealth.
That's right.
America does not use her vast resources of wealth to end poverty. Make it possible for all of God's children to have the basic necessities of life. She too will go to hell.
It's that final message where he's using the idea that the United States is great as a weapon against those that believe it's great but also stand in the way of progress. So the fact that America's great but yet we have poverty and yet we have all these issues means that America can't be great. And that really pisses some people off. And it's one of those ways that you get sympathy on the one side because they want to be great. They want to make it so everybody can have it. And the other thing that King does well and is captured here in most of those speeches is he uses religion, which in the 60s was still alive and well. And he uses that as another, I guess, leg of his stool of why civil rights matter, which is that we're all God's children. And one of the issues that we're seeing here is that if we're all God's children, are all equal in his eyes, why is America not treating us that way? And again, it's the messaging. It has to do with how can King get through to the individuals who don't want to believe there's a problem or are unwilling to see the problem or maybe just don't care. There's no issue in their life. And that's the same messaging issue we have now today.
And the point about religion is important because effectively, this quote says, if you believe in God, you should value having the absence of poverty and access to basic necessities. It's a tautological statement about what the obligations of being a believer of God entail. And then he ends it by saying, if you don't do this, you will go to hell, which is another principal tenet of religion. And it supports his entire idea, which is ending poverty. And so together, the entire premise is basically, if you believe in God, you should want to end poverty. Otherwise, you will go to hell. That's effectively what this message is.
Yeah, it's so funny, too. It's so great because it's taunting people, right? How do you claim to be a Christian you're going to go to heaven when we all know you're going to go to hell? You know, how is it easy enough for a rich man to go to heaven, right? And we know the proverbs, the parables, right? They can't. How do you not feed your brother? How does Jesus make, you know, food for everybody, but you can't?
And you're seeing this be weaponized by the right wing, where they wrap themselves in the religious concept and scream about whatever inane policy position that capital wants to foist on, you know, poor people. And if you say, if you believe in God, you should want taxes on corporations to be lower, otherwise you'll go to hell. Like, it's functionally the same pattern. But Martin Luther King is using it to advance what he actually is a social good, which is ending poverty. He's attempting to speak in these religious terms because there's a segment of the population that cares. And you don't see Democratic politicians talking about religion at all anymore.
Well, because they lost that fight, right?
Yep.
They lost it because it's gone. Just like they lost the fight to the court we talked about before. They don't have a message, so they're just lost. You can't get it back. And if you try to get it back, you just come off as a fucking weirdo because it's so far gone now. There's just no way to get it back.
And it's a little bit interesting in the context of the Georgia election because Warnock was a pastor and he was accused of being a Marxist. That happened. And you saw he's a black guy and he won an election in Georgia. It's very similar to the presentation that Martin Luther King does in this quote. If you believe in God, you should want to end poverty. And if you don't, you'll go to hell. And I think to some extent he was able to harness that religious concept for positive outcomes.
Yep. I don't see any problem with it myself.
Another concept that is similar that's happened recently is Bernie Sanders has his sayings where
it's about saying that at a time when every major country on earth guarantees health care to all of their people, we should be doing the same in our great country.
It's a very similar phrasing, but it doesn't have religion, which is fine.
Nope.
If we are rich, similar to America has vast resources, and we don't use it to provide health care, it's an open question. What should happen? Martin Luther King answered it by saying you're going to go to hell. Bernie left a little bit more open. But it's effectively the same messaging. It lets whoever the listener is fill in what the negative consequence is. Perhaps without invoking religion, because as we just discussed, the Dems have completely lost the religious bloc.
And now that they lost it, people are cynical when it comes to listening to them talk about it, because they've lost for so long. And the other thing is that the right has done a great job of conflating religion with abortion. So they've done a great job messaging that they're the only ones that can do it because, right, they're the ones that are right to life. And that conflation is actually a really good messaging on their end. I don't agree with it. I just think it's a really good messaging point on their end to fight it that way.
And if you are religious and you support abortion, you're not religious, is what the right's framing is.
Yeah, it's the same thing. How can you be religious but support abortion? How can you be religious and not support universal health care? Right. So it's just a weaponization of your belief system. It makes you question your beliefs and your ideologies, and it's just. If your core tenets are to help other individuals, you're going to listen to the message of Martin and Bernie. If your core tenets are psychopathic and authoritarian, you may listen to the right wing. I have no respect for the right wing.
The theme throughout all of Martin Luther King's quotes here is that he speaks in the language of class struggle, and he makes an appeal to the working class that if you follow these tenets, it will be better for everybody.
Absolutely.
And he talked about that in terms of advancing progress locally, the white moderate quote. He talked about ending imperialism nationally because it disproportionately affects the poor, both
yep.
internationally and domestically in terms of the draft. He talked about the redistribution of wealth and why that is important to advocate for general equity everywhere. And then he talks about how if we don't do this, these are the consequences, but he frames it in a manner that is accessible to the people listening, by wrapping it in a religious concept that's understood by everybody.
Absolutely. The key takeaway from the two podcasts is that Martin Luther King was a religious man. His religion is what pushed him in his ideologies and his belief system. But he was also a great leader who was able to bring together groups of individuals from different diverse backgrounds to fight for a common good. And he was able to do that because he understood the messaging and he understood of the way to communicate with everybody and every stakeholder that was needed in order to push through civil rights. And he did it in a way that was able to weaponize what he had around him to have the greatest resource allocation on the other side. He had the ability to really draw out his enemy and make them waste unfathomable amount of resources fighting a small group of individuals.
For future episodes and to learn more about the worker movement, join us at workermovement.com.